Hello, and welcome back to the Gene Wolfe Literary Podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buda. In today's episode, we'll be talking about the Ray Bradbury story, All Summer in a Day. This story was originally published in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction in 1954.
This episode was commissioned by a really, truly generous Patreon supporter, and we are very, very grateful for this commission. Commissions help keep the shows going, of course, but in this case, it's just really awesome to get the impetus to cover some Ray Bradbury. We've been aware for a long time, I guess, that Bradbury was influential on a lot of Gene Wolfe's early work. Bradbury has been even more influential, I think, on Neil Gaiman, whom, of course, we do another show on the network. But still, we've actually, across the whole network, only managed to ever cover two Bradbury stories before. Those were The Veldt, which we did on Elder Sign, I mean, just years and years ago at this point, and then also Something Wicked This Way Comes, which I did alone over on Atas, also years ago. And we have just never gotten to go back to Bradbury until now. So it's really awesome to get the impetus to do that. Before we begin, though, I do want to say that I have had the chance to talk more about Ray Bradbury when very recently I was a guest on the dedicated Ray Bradbury podcast, The Bradbury Chronicles, which is hosted by John DeGreiter. So if you are a big Bradbury fan, or really even if you're just a small Bradbury fan and you have not listened to The Bradbury Chronicles, I recommend it. I'll put a link in the show notes for that as well.
Yeah, definitely check out the Bradbury Chronicles. I am someone who has maybe wavered in the past in their appreciation of Ray Bradbury. This story really clicked with me, though, in a lot of ways and made me really want to go back and read a lot more Bradbury. But this story's awesome. There's nothing I want to say about it before we get started because it's short and dealing with some surprisingly complex topics. So why don't we just jump right into it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we will perhaps talk about in the discussion is just how short this story is, yet how much is packed into it. It is a masterclass on how to really write a short story, like a short story, a story that is very short. And it's awesome. It's just a breathtaking story. But I won't belabor the point. I will get us into it here. So this story takes place on Venus. It's a Venus that has been colonized by humans. And this colonization has happened in fairly typical Ray Bradbury fashion, meaning that he's not interested in envisioning Venus as a place that cannot naturally sustain human life, right? This is, it's not a story about conquering a wild place or about terraforming a planet. For Bradbury, in this story, Venus is a place that humans can live on, more or less as they live here on Earth. And the real challenges to colonizing Venus are simply that you need rocket ships to get there. And perhaps more importantly, you need a real frontier spirit in order to want to do it in the first place. And this is more or less how Bradbury writes about Mars in his more famous works as well. Okay, so that is the setting. It's a human colony on Venus, and really, it's basically an American suburb or an American small town, except that it's on Venus. And our cast of characters for this story are children, something that is also fairly typical of Ray Bradbury. In fact, all the Bradbury stories, both the Bradbury stories that we've done on the network are about kids. And these kids here in this story, they are 9, so third graders, I guess. And the deal is that they are very excited because today they are going to see the sun for the very first time. Because, you see, Venus is really, really rainy. And here's what Bradbury writes about this. It had been raining for 7 years, thousands upon thousands of days, compounded and filled from one end to the other with rain, with the drum and gush of water, with the sweet crystal fall of showers, and the concussion of storms so heavy they were tidal waves come over the islands.
All of these passages about rain and sun have a poetic quality to them that I find really beautiful. This is such a poetically written story. Also, in this passage that you just read, that's where we learned the fact that we are on Venus instead of some version of Earth, as you know, we've pointed out already, and that the weather on Venus is really bad, instead of us, you know, thinking that the weather on Earth has like gone out of control or something like that. But this story was written before the first probes were sent to Venus, before they landed there. That was the early 1960s. There was some indication that the atmosphere was hostile to humans prior to those probe landings, but no one really knew about the weather conditions on Venus. Now I can just click a link in my pocket library of Alexandria and learn everything about Venus. For instance, I can learn very quickly that it doesn't actually rain on the planet. But I think that the major idea that Bradbury is running with here is that Venus is within the sun's habitable zone, and it's only a little smaller than Earth, and it doesn't have quite as much sci-fi baggage, culturally speaking, as Mars. So there's something to Bradbury's decision, something we'll think about when we talk about this story in a little bit. Anyway, this story is actually only a little bit about weather on Venus, and it would be a mistake, I think, to approach this story as a bit of hard sci, something you might even come across just 10 years earlier in the history of science fiction in the 40s, during more of the Golden Age period. This story is about people, and more specifically, it's about children, the majority of whom, as you've mentioned, Glenn, have never seen the sun.
Right. And our main character is a 9-year-old named Margot. And Margot is not like the other children because they're all native Venusians. But Margot is a Terran, meaning she was born on Earth. And in fact, she lived in Ohio until she was 4. And that means that Margot remembers the sun. And this impacts her life on Venus. She's not happy here. She lives in a city that is at least in part underground and that never sees the sun. And so she doesn't play with the other kids. She doesn't sing in class unless the song that they're singing happens to be about the sun. Now, naturally, when Margot tries to tell the other kids what the sun is like, they get upset. They call her a liar. And there is also a rumor that her parents are going to take her back to Earth, even though it's very, very expensive to do so. And so, of course, because of that as well, the other kids seem to hate her.
There was a moment when I was reading this story that I felt it was going to be a Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer type of story, but I think it's much better than that. The rivalry, though, is at play here, and the kids' rivalry with Margot is rooted very much in Margot's being different. Bradbury writes that the children hate Margot's, quote, pale snow face, her waiting silence, her thinness, and her possible future. And that future is the potential and the possibility that she'll be returning to Earth, a place that these kids, I think it's right to call them native Venusians, but they came when they were 2. They have no memories of Earth. But really, these are symbols of the real issue, which is that Margot has experienced something the other kids haven't. And as a result, they're really cruel to her. There's also an element in this bit of text that shows us what it's like to be a student in the classroom on Venus. This feels a little bit like indoctrination. It's almost like sun worship, maybe, in the classroom. All the kids are writing essays and poems or just creatively about what the sun is like. Margot writes a cute little poem about the sun on Venus. I'll read it. It's this. She says, "I think the sun is a flower that blooms for just 1 hour." And I really love this poem. It's very sweet. But I think that this is something I did in elementary school, too. This kind of level of, capitalizing or exploring anticipation for something. Maybe we did this about patriotism. I can't remember now. I remember we built the Alaskan pipeline out of straws in 4th grade. But the point is that Bradbury's depiction of classroom activities here feels true to life for me.
Yeah, we definitely did this sort of thing in grade school. Halley's Comet came by when I was really probably about the age that Margot and her other classmates are now. And I remember, it feels like that entire year of school was actually just us doing stuff about Halley's Comet, but of course, you know, it wasn't, but it was a big part of that year. There was the year after that, actually a fairly significant solar eclipse as well. And we spent a ton of time doing that. Of course, there were shuttle launches and there were probes sent out into parts of the solar system as well that were made a big deal out of. And we did all sorts of things like that. One of my more visceral memories of this, though, of course, is that I watched the Challenger explode live on TV in a school assembly. And we had done so much work about what that mission was going to be for that space shuttle and all of the astronauts who were on that for, you know, weeks leading up to that. And were so excited, and then watched it blow up on TV. I think they put those things on time delays now for that. And it was actually a fairly traumatic experience.
Yeah, we watched the OJ trial when I was in fifth grade. So we had a very different, I think, education system. I don't know. Maybe our school was way more into worshiping civic and procedural matters rather than space. But yeah, it's weird though, right? To think about how much of elementary school is caught up in like this astronomical world and thinking about it. And yeah, when there was a solar eclipse, we absolutely spent a whole week, you know, like cutting holes in tissue boxes and stuff so we could look through them. But this, because the sun only comes out so infrequently in the story, this feels a lot more like worship.
Yes, there is definitely a sense here of a kind of nascent sun cult. And you definitely could take this world that Bradbury envisions here as a starting point for inventing your own world. You know, what is Venus like? What is human civilization on Venus like? I don't know, a century from now, 2 centuries from now, when contact with Earth has been lost for some reason, and yeah, the sun comes out for 2 hours every 7 years. You know, 7 already being a significant number in the basic religion probably of most of the people who have come, given that they're all Americans here at this point. Yeah, I mean, I would read that book for sure. But all right, let's take this story home here. We've talked about the setting, we've talked about the characters, but you know, something is actually going to happen in this story. So let me explain the plot here. The plot is that the kids decide it would be funny if they locked Margot in a closet for the 2 hours when the sun is out. And this is something that is possible because the teacher is out of the classroom for some reason. And so they do it. They just do this. And even though Margot now is pounding on the door of the closet and screaming to be let out, the other kids, just in their regular chatter, are loud enough that the teacher doesn't hear Margot when she returns. And this teacher also doesn't counter students. She just rhetorically asks if everyone is here and ready and just accepts that, you know, the answer of yes from the students who are there suggests that everyone is there. I mean, this is very bad guidance here, or guardianship from this teacher. At any rate, she just doesn't know that Margot's in this closet. And so the other kids go outside and they get to play in the sunshine for 2 hours. At the end of the 2 hours, the rain begins to return, and this passage here, Bradbury's descriptive writing, is just unbeatable. I won't read any of it at this point, but wow, just blew me away. But the resolution of the story is that just as the kids are rushing back into the tunnels of their community, they realize that they had forgotten to let Margot out. They meant to, they just forgot about it. And now they're all ashamed of what they've done. They can't look each other in the eyes. But finally, they muster the courage to open the door, and here's how Bradbury ends the story. Behind the closet door was only silence. They unlocked the door, even more slowly, and let Margot out.
It's so cruel what the children have done, but I blame the teacher. What kind of teacher for a serious event like this wouldn't count the students, have them line up, you know, and so on? Like, who would just let kids loose in the tunnels that lead to the outside on Venus? She must have known, too, that the kids had been cruel to Margot and the reasons why, and might have considered that Margot might need a little extra care and attention and looking after. She would definitely be aware if Margot was not there, unless this is like 80 kids or something. But I think that it's not Bradbury's goal with the story to interrogate the teacher, or he might have some broader contextual reasons for thinking about a world in which the teachers are ignoring some of their students or not caring for them, though they need extra care. And so I actually don't have too much for the discussion, but I do want to start with the social context. This story was published in the same year that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled to end segregation in public schools in the Brown versus the Board of Education case. And this is a story that does carry skin color as a component in highlighting the children's cruelty. And so, Glenn, I wonder if you felt as though Bradbury might have had the end of segregation on his mind here in this story. And if he does, what is he commenting on?
I wondered about this as well. I don't know. You know, we know when this story was published. I guess we don't really know necessarily when it was written, though I do think that, you know, by this point, Bradbury was a big enough name that stories were published if he sent them along. So probably it hadn't been sitting in a trunk or going back and forth in the mail for too long before it saw print. So it might be the case that segregation was something that was on his mind. Certainly there are two different groups of people here. There are people who came to Venus and the first wave of rocket ships, and then people who came after. Margot is in the people who came after group. Even though it is only by 2 years, that's half the lifetime for these kids. And so although we don't see anything about the adult world really at all, and don't even know anything about this teacher, certainly there is this kind of stratification for the kids, at least. And I imagine that Margot is not the only kid who has come late to Venus. And, you know, we might find in other grades that there are more kids like Margot who are also being ostracized or picked on or even just treated really hatefully by some of the other kids. But in terms of what Bradbury might be getting a contemporary audience to think about in terms of segregation, that I'm less clear on. You know, this is not on the nose about that the way that maybe Star Trek would do in the 1960s. So yeah, I'm not quite sure what, you know, the metaphor, the analogy really would be that Bradbury's going for here in terms of getting an audience, getting his readers to change their minds about something or even take action about something. What were your thoughts on that?
I struggle too with this idea, kind of picking it apart and seeing how it applies to the story. You know, I read the passage earlier about how the children hate her pale white face. And so part of me wonders if Bradbury's saying like, okay, schools are going to be integrated, or there's the potential that there will be integration. How would you feel if your white kid was going to be cruelly picked on the same way that, you know, we expect teachers and white kids to pick on and be cruel to the black kids who are going to be in the school? So I think he's maybe trying to say something about that. He's trying to make race strange. He's trying to point out, you know, maybe in that Carl Sagan-esque, you know, pale blue dot sense that, you know, we're all one race. And so like we have these artificial distinctions and it's childish to be cruel to one another because of them. And so that's what I think is going on. I do think it's a little clumsily handled, but I don't know if it would be if in 1954, this is in every newspaper every week. This is what people are talking about. This is a massive civic shift that people are preparing for. And Bradbury's very gently kind of prodding the issue in a science fiction context.
Well, and at this point, Bradbury has already written about race in America in a science fiction setting. Famously, one of the stories from his 1951 collection, The Illustrated Man, this is a story called The Other Foot, is about Black Americans colonizing Mars in order to escape Jim Crow treatment. And they establish a kind of paradise for themselves there. And the story there, which I won't spoil for people who maybe want to go check it out and haven't already, but it hinges on the knowledge that white people are on their way in their own rocket ship. And it's a really, really great story. So we know that this is something that is on Bradbury's mind, that he is aware of race and how it matters in America. He's aware of segregation and sees it as an evil and is envisioning a society that can be better. Though, of course, Bradbury is pretty dark, right? He looks at human darkness straight on. And so it's not a happy ending. I mean, and there's certainly darkness and not a happy ending in this story as well. But I did actually wonder, I'm not certain that the other kids in this class are not white either. I read that description of Margot there as actually a small bit of hard science fiction from Bradbury, and that he's illustrating that, of course, people are going to be pale on Venus because they haven't seen the sun in 7 years.
I also thought about that too and wondered if her paleness was the result of some kind of maladaptive response to living on Venus after having been exposed to the sun for 4 years or whatever. And now she's, you know, the pigments leaching from her hair and skin or something like that. I wasn't quite sure. But yeah, I also, you know, there's no reason for us to assume that the kids are white other than they're, you know, American, and it's the 50s, and that's, you know, the cultural assumption to make from a white writer. However, they don't have to be. And it could also just be that Bradbury's commenting on the way gradations of skin color worked traditionally in America with relation to a culture of passing and so on and so forth. So yeah, I'm doing a lot of stretching here to make it work, but I don't think that the language Bradbury is using is a mistake. And I think, and I do wonder if integration is on his mind, and he's trying to get his readers to think about cruelty towards children is no response to what is going to take place in this country in the next year. As you know, these civic institutions are going to experience a pretty radical change.
Well, I think this is an open question for me, and I would actually love to hear what listeners have to say about this, just because my memory of The Other Foot, it's been, I don't know, probably 7 or 8 years since I read that story, is that this is, well, actually, been closer to 10 years since I read that story, but my memory of The Other Foot is that, you know, Bradbury is being extremely explicit in confronting this issue head on. It doesn't mean that he hasn't been more oblique about it or subtle about it in other places, but this feels to me like it's more subtle than Bradbury needs to be for this to be a front and center issue. But it still may be there.
Yeah, I agree. I found it to be really obliquely handled. Let's move on here. This is a sci-fi story, so let's talk about the sci-fi business in the story. As we've been kind of, I think, hinting at, or I have been, I feel as though this story doesn't need to be set on Venus. With a few tweaks, this story could be set on Earth, and the details of the cruelty of the children could be just about anything. It could be set anywhere. What impact do you think Bradbury is going for by giving this story, the setting of Venus, and then giving Venus the weather system that it has?
This is Bradbury's whole shtick, right? That almost all of his stories feature some kind of speculative element. He is a speculative fiction writer, but he is mostly writing about characters. He's writing about people, as you said earlier. And so the high concept stuff doesn't always matter all that much. I mean, sometimes it does. You know, he's got some time travel, accidentally getting the wrong person elected president stories. He's got stuff going wrong in a spaceship type stories and so on. But for the most part, Bradbury writes stories that focus really on the human. And so in this case then, and in many of those other cases, the setting is kind of a MacGuffin. It doesn't really matter what it is. You could, as you suggest, Brandon, come up with something else that would do the same thing, that would put these kids in a similar scenario. So then the question is, right, why bother with Venus? But I think that thinking about it in terms of why bother with Venus is maybe the wrong angle, right? I mean, I think that Bradbury's first entry to this is it would be fun to write a story about Venus. Certainly, from my perspective as a reader, that's what would draw me to it, right? If you gave me a summary of this story in two sentences and didn't tell me it was on Venus, I probably wouldn't be that interested in it. You tell me it's on Venus, well, now I'm interested because I want to know what life on Venus is like, or what a society on Venus is going to be like. And I especially want to know what someone in the 1950s thought a human society on Venus was going to be like. So I think that that the setting there matters to Bradbury in terms of it being fun, being an interesting world to explore. And I think that the MacGuffin is not just a MacGuffin for Bradbury. I think he's probably genuinely interested in what would it be like to live in a world where people don't see the sun all that often? How would that affect a variety of things? And he picks one very small thing to tug on and to turn into a story, which is really the art of the short story, and imagines, what would this do to nine-year-olds? What effect would this have on nine-year-olds? And let me explore that.
It's a really brilliant conceit, and it kind of leads into maybe the last real discussion question I have that we can talk about craft if we want here. But really, this is more about the history of science fiction, you know, where I'm thinking about sort of what you're talking about here, Glenn. Like, what are the conceptual reasons that are leading to the creation and development of a Venusian colony, right? Bradbury doesn't give us context in the story of why people are going to Venus. Is Earth failing? Is it because they want to explore and pioneer? And historically speaking, categorically speaking as well, the 50s were right between what we call the golden age of science fiction and the new wave, where the golden age was some of this more hard SF speculative stuff, and the new wave was more about literary merit, exploring human psychology in these settings, what are people like if you tweak the setting. And so this story definitely has some of these new wave features. I mentioned, you know, the prose is particularly poetic. It doesn't rely on any hard sci-fi features. But to me, this story feels like in the background, it's carrying that optimism for the future that you often find, I think, in golden age of science fiction stories where, you know, technology is a good. Space is something we're pioneering out into. It's not because Earth is failing. It's because we can, and we should explore the universe. So what do you think Bradbury has in mind in terms of why people are going to Venus? Why we're establishing colonies in space? You know, did you get the sense that we can't live on Earth anymore because it's been destroyed? Or where does the cynicism and optimism in this story lie for you?
Right. Well, the idea of Earth being destroyed and there being nowhere else to live in the solar system except Mars is a big part of the short stories that get repurposed to make up the Martian Chronicles, which is certainly one of Bradbury's most famous works. That's a big part of that, of, you know, what makes Earth uninhabitable or unlivable, at least for some people, or what it is that drives people to go to colonize Mars is to get away from the Cold War, to get away from the very real threat of nuclear war, which is a huge part of the 1950s and the 1960s. This is a fear, a very real fear that people were living with. And so that might also be the driving force here, although it's not present in the text. But as I said, Bradbury also has written about marginalized people wanting to leave the society that marginalizes them and to go find something better out on the frontier, this new frontier in space. And so, as you're pointing out, that might actually be what's going on here as well. And it's hard to say given the context of this story, but I will say that this does seem to be a pleasant place to live here on Venus. I mean, you know, people don't seem to like the rain, but it's a nice community, right? It's got a school, it's got designated school teacher. It's a big enough community to have this sort of tunnel network, and it's made up of, you know, a whole network of families who seem to be materially surviving just fine. There doesn't seem to be any hardship there, though that is something we do sometimes encounter on Bradbury's Mars from time to time. And I guess there is one detail as well in the story that suggests that Earth is not so awful that it has to be escaped, which is this rumor that Margot's parents are going to take her back. Now, we don't know that that is a true thing. This might just be something that the other third graders are saying that they have made up. It may be that Earth is blowed up and doesn't, you know, they can't go back, but the third graders don't know that. But at least there's some sense that Earth is a place that people could go back to, and also a sense that Earth is still better than here. And we do also get all this information about how expensive it is to make these journeys. And so it does seem like probably, you know, getting to, you know, the impetus here of your question, Brandon, the heart of your question, it does seem that probably these are people who have left Earth for financial reasons, that they're looking for opportunity. They're looking for prosperity for their family on the frontier, much of the same reason that people moved west in the United States after the Civil War. I think probably that's what we're meant to envision here as well. Possibly it's that NASA has been really successful and gotten humans on Venus, planted an American flag there, claimed Venus for America. And now, in order to encourage colonization, the U.S. government is essentially giving land away or offering other types of financial incentives to people. So I think that's the world I would envision here, is something like that, rather than a nuclear holocaust or trying to escape persecution or something like that. But I think there's room for those things as well.
Yeah, that feels right to me. Not the nuclear holocaust and you know, Puritans fleeing England type of situation, but more of a pioneering sensibility. That's the feeling I get in this story. There's definitely technology on Venus that makes up for the lack of sunlight. We learned that there's day lamps and all sorts of stuff. And so there's some material comfort on this planet, even though it's not really ideal for human life to flourish. You can survive there, and flourishing will come with time, I think. And so, yeah, people are making the choice to leave Earth rather than being forced to leave Earth. And so that has that sense of maybe golden age optimism, while still being a pretty cynical story about how, you know, technology is not going to fix what's wrong with us as a species. And so, yeah, this story is pretty amazing. Have you come across this story before, Glenn? Is this the first time you read it?
It was not the first time I'd read it, though I can't remember the context for reading it. And in fact, when we got the commission, I had to do a little bit of digging to find, you know, which collections it was in, because it's not in any of the big Bradbury collections. So I have no idea what the context was in which I had read this before. And I didn't know when we got the commission that I had read it before, but as soon as I read even just the first page of it, I remembered everything about the story. I remembered viscerally reading it, just not at all the context of reading it, which might suggest that actually I had read this in school at some point. But how about you?
Yeah, same. It had this deep sense of familiarity with it. And I can't tell if we had watched this like short adaptation of it at some point. I don't think it was made for the Ray Bradbury Theater, but it was so familiar to me. And I was like, I know this story. Why do I know it? I don't know. This is a deeply familiar story. I might have read it as part of a reading club in like fourth or fifth grade that I was in. And it might have been in one of those books. I might have come across it in a magazine. Like, I don't know, maybe it was reprinted in Highlights and I read it at the dentist's office. I just don't know. I have no idea. But it's such a good story. And I was so glad to revisit it, even though, you know, I can't imagine where I would have read it before.
I literally just this morning subscribed Finch to the toddler edition of Highlights, which is called Cricket. And so I'm glad to hear you have fond memories of that as well, because that might also be where I encountered it. Certainly, that was a big part of my life. But maybe this brings up a broader question, especially in light of the fact that we also very recently have covered Flowers for Algernon, which is also a story about people being cruel to each other. It's about cruelty, but it is a story that you had read in middle school, in eighth grade, I think you had said, and part of the reason there was to try to teach adolescents something about empathy. Is this a story that you would assign to kids in school? And if so, what grade level do you think you would use this at? And maybe another approach might be, since neither of us are actually grade school teachers, at what point do you think you would introduce this to your child?
I think this is a perfect like fourth or fifth grade story. And I don't know what kind of it's clearly about like, don't be cruel. Like, wouldn't you feel bad if kids were mean to you? Like they're mean to Margot. Though there's a lot of real humanity in the story also for the kids. I think Bradbury recognizes that kids are working out all of this stuff. And so they can do something cruel and something will overtake that. And then they'll have to come back and face reality. The shocking thing to me in this story is the teacher's real disinterest in engaging kids on this behavior that she sees and never noticing that Margot's gone, because the teacher is also in this cult of sun worship as well. And she just wants to get out in the sun, right? You get that sense too in the story that there's too much excitement to really be aware of the full scope of circumstances that are taking place. But to me, this is, I would just probably introduce the story to my kid, depending on how I'd see their behavior developing, somewhere between third and fifth grade, and then see what they take away from the story rather than trying to guide them in a discussion.
Yeah, I think that would be the age range that I would leave this story lying around the house as well. And I guess this is an experiment we could try. So we'll report back in a few years and see how that goes. But on a serious note, I do think that there's a lot of merit in this story. I love the way that Bradbury writes children. This is something he does, I think, better than just about anyone, because he sees kids for who and what they really are. He writes about kids on their own terms. Bradbury does have a real nostalgia for his own childhood. He has, I think, a real deep-seated desire to have a do-over on his childhood as well, or at least to, you know, have the ability to jump back into his younger body and enjoy it all over again. And this is a feeling I think that most of us have at some point. But Bradbury still never writes about childhood as if kids are little angels to be worshipped or something like that. Kids are just as real and fully fleshed out people as adults for Bradbury. And I love that about everything he writes. And I think it's on full display here. And I think that's what makes this a particularly useful story that would be great for kids in that age range to read. You could see kids who maybe are being cruel to other kids that they know reading this story and being given the opportunity to feel bad about their own behavior, to reflect on it and think about it. You can also envision a kid who's being picked on at school reading this story. And even though there is no happy ending here for Margot in this story, still finding some solace and comfort and solidarity in the experience of Margot. And so even though this is a story about kids being really awful to each other, I think that kids in any part of this scenario in their real life would get something positively out of this story. And that's a real masterpiece.
And I think so many kids, if my experience can be, expanded to being universal, so many kids feel both sides of this. They feel picked on and respond maybe with cruelty in ways they don't understand. And they're both, right? They're both the kids who are doing the picking on, and they're both experiencing that feeling of maybe isolation or alienation from some in-group or something like that. And so I think that any kid in this age range that we're talking about is probably going through a lot emotionally and would learn from both groups of characters. And it would be interesting to see, I think, especially with your own kid, who they identify with more. And then as their parent, seeing whether or not their behavior matches up with their identification, and whether they're using their sense of identification to justify bad behavior or something like that. There's a lot you can do with this story. Neither of us are psychologists. We're muddling our way through this parenthood business, I think, with as much outside help as we can. But yeah, it's a phenomenal story. And I do think, you know, if kids are treated as just embodied concepts, they can never grow into being good people. And so there has to be room, I think, for kids to screw up. And this story, I think, treats every character with a measure of grace here. And it's a wonderful bit of writing.
Well, I like that you have essentially just pitched the idea for Clay Temple Jr. as the kids podcast, the podcast we're going to come up with the discussion questions for our own kids to talk about and record. Yeah, now it's actually just slave labor for, you know, yes, they're child labor laws against this for sure. But I guess as a listener, I would actually be interested in that. And it might be something that we do at, I don't know, when we get together for picnics and stuff as our kids get older. This might be how we do it. I'm sure they'll love it.
I'm sure they will too, yes, except we're their parents, so it's hard to say. I think now, as we're just talking about parenthood, we should probably leave this story behind. So that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buddha.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. And before we sign off, I do just want to remind listeners that you can hear me talk about Ray Bradbury even more over on The Bradbury Chronicles, where I had the pleasure of being a guest. And of course, that's just one episode that I was on. It's a fantastic show. The regular episodes with John are fantastic, and I hope you'll go check that out and also subscribe to it.
I also want to here at the end just thank our very generous Patreon supporter for commissioning this episode. This was such a blast to revisit. We had a great time talking about this. So thank you so much. And if you have an idea for something you want to commission, you can find out information about that on our website. But until next time, we greet you and say farewell.